Hello, everyone, and welcome back to our second episode of Flushing is Burning. I'm Grace Carbone, and I'm here with Christian Romo. Christian, how you doing?
Doing okay. I was looking forward to seeing Ohtani at 9 a.m. before I forgot that MLB blackouts are a thing. And I can't watch the Angels or the Dodgers anywhere in my home. And that's, you know, perfectly fine for me on most days because I'm not an Angel or a Dodgers fan. But I would have liked to have seen Ohtani earlier today.
Yeah, I got hit with the blackouts. I was at work a couple days ago on Saturday, it was, when they had the 4 o'clock game. And I was going to turn it on just for a little bit before I left. And it was on Pix. And SNY doesn't stream Pix anymore. You can't get it on MLB TV. So I would have had to AirPlay my laptop to the TV, and that was too much work.
Yeah, and for the record, I am not against the illegal pirating of streams in order to make it happen. But I think my issue is that I'm getting close to 30 years old, and I just want to pay for a service that like shows a game. And I don't know how the SNY app works because I've never had to use it because I can just stream Mets games on MLB.tv. But how is the SNY app in general?
It's not terrible. There's definitely still some bugs in there where like I'll click on stuff and it'll just stop working halfway through the game. You got to exit out and go back in. It's better than the Yes app, I'll tell you that much.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah. I don't watch Yankees games. I just want to put that out there. I use the Yes app for the New York Liberty.
Yes, the Nets as well. It's a basketball app for me as well.
Yeah. It's just deeply frustrating because a lot of Liberty games, that's the only way you can watch. And the app sucks so much.
Mm-hmm. Dang. Well, Yankees better get on that, I guess.
All right. So might as well get into the actual baseball part of this instead of just complaining about the various ways we can't watch our favorite sports. Within the last week, since the last episode, they've started their trip through all of the California teams. So they started with the Padres. They took 2 out of 3 in that series. That was a fun series, even with the loss.
It was. And even the loss was competitive. So it was the first bright spot of the season where you could definitively say that the Mets were competitive against another competitive team. And I don't necessarily think it makes up for last October, but you know, it's nice to take 2 out of 3 from a really good team.
Yeah, I was at the Monday game, as I noted last Monday when we recorded, and I guess I must have opposite jinx to them because they actually looked good against Darvish for once. Mm-hmm. There was nothing more fun than being in the stadium for those two hits that landed right on the foul line. I've never had so just I was in the club. It was getting a little too cold. So I was in the club. Whole place erupted in cheers. It was so much fun.
I screamed from my bedroom and my partner came running down asking like, what just happened? And I was like, the Mets hit a ball like 20 feet. I swear it's the coolest thing. And then they did it again.
It was really fun. And I mean, they're looking better than they did those that first 10 games of the season. I mean, this and against the A's, even yesterday when they kind of, you know, it was a little touch and go there for a second. They looked really good. It's always fun when you have a game where you score 17 runs.
Oh, yeah. And that 17-run game, like, it could have been a lot worse because I remember thinking to myself as the game was going on, is this the worst pitching performance I've ever seen just from a single relay of pitchers? And then when the walks crept up to 15, to 16, and finally to 17, thought, yeah, this is the worst pitching performance I have ever seen. Very sorry to all the Athletic fans out there. And I'm glad that like they were able to show a lot more competitive spirit in the next two games because I would have hated two more blowouts. But the Mets faced off against what is quite probably the worst team in baseball. And regardless of how touchy it was for the Sunday game, they swept them. They did exactly what they needed to do. And can't really complain about that outcome.
I gotta say, after watching the A's these past couple games and even seeing them, like their Orioles series and stuff like that, I'm starting to think the ball's juiced again.
Really? What makes you say
that? They're scoring like 6, 7, 8 runs. And I mean, those players are fun and they're like, they're good. But also, I don't know, those balls are really, there was certain hits where I was like, that probably shouldn't have gone that far.
I'm starting to wonder if Major League Baseball is selectively juicing, because they got caught in, what was it, 2019, with the offensive explosion, when it seemed as if the balls were being juiced en masse. Last year was a pretty down offensive year for everyone except for Aaron Judge. And I think there was a significant speculation that any Yankees games had juiced balls because the home run chase is marketable. And so I wonder if Major League Baseball is doing this for select teams, select stadiums, select games, because I do think you're right. There are definitely moments where Pete Alonso, like, doesn't sound like he makes hard contact, but then it goes 450 to dead center and hits halfway up Mount Davis. And then there's other occasions where, like, Starling Marte is, like, hitting the crap out of the ball and somehow it's just not getting over the fence.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely not as bad as it was in 2019. You know, like, that was crazy. But, and the whole thing about it getting, they kind of did prove that. I know Meredith Wills went on a pod of their own on our network here, and she was talking about it. I know they've done studies. A lot of those balls towards the end with the Aaron Judge thing were it wasn't juiced. It wasn't unjuiced. It was a secret third thing for some reason that it was like the perfectly constructed ball. Part of me is like, it's fun to be like, oh, they're doing this to like to create these moments and stuff like that. Part of me thinks they're just too dumb to realize what they're doing, because that seems to be like the theme of the last 10 years of baseball. It's just things happen because they're too dumb to realize what they're doing, or they're too focused in this one path that they don't realize the ripple effects of this.
Yeah. Unintended consequences is kind of the theme of the Major League Baseball season this year, huh? I think that there is also a possibility that Major League Baseball just is incapable of constructing a baseball that is the same from game to game. Like they pretty clearly have been on the record saying all of our baseballs just come out differently because that is the way we manufacture them. And it might have effects like this. I don't know. I'm not Dr. Meredith Wills. I haven't studied any of this, but I do think you're on to something with this idea that the balls might be juiced in some instances.
If the balls are juiced, even if they weren't juiced, I think Alonso and Lindor would still be doing what they're doing, though. I mean, Alonso's hit 8 home runs in 16 games. That's insane.
Yeah. Yeah. that's on pace for 81. And he would not hit 81, obviously. Like, once you get to a certain point, pitchers stop pitching to you. But that hasn't happened yet. They're still pitching to Pete. What's really funny to me about Alonso's season is that he's hit 8 home runs. He's arguably one of the 5 best hitters in baseball right now. And he's not even close to the WAR leader on the Mets, because that's just how good Francisco Lindor is playing on both sides of the ball.
That's the thing. You know, Alonso's insane as a hitter. I hope they lock him up for the rest of his career. I'd love to see Alonso as a Met for the next 10 years, 15 years, however long he ends up playing. But Francisco Lindor is... Alonso's a great hitter. He's not the world's best defender. And even if you are at first base, you know, it's not as important as shortstop defense. And Lindor is so insanely good at shortstop. I mean, I was a kid when Jose Reyes was playing, and a lot of my memories of him are now tainted by what we know about him. But he was electric. But I mean, the best defensive shortstop the Mets ever had was Ray Ordonez. Lindor's given him a run for his money with some of the stuff that he is able to do.
Yeah, my memories of Ray Ordonez are couched in highlights, because I did not watch, you know, all 162 in 1999. But from what I recall, Ray Ordonez was the holy shit, I had never seen a play like this before. Whereas Lindor is just, every single play comes to him and it's natural, and you never ever worry about it getting done. Like he would be like Hank Aaron, and Ordonez would be like Willie Mays. Like Ordonez is going to make the highlight reel play every single night. But yeah, Lindor is just so silky, and he's in the right place every single time. I don't know if it's necessarily like a joy to watch him play defense, because it's just so easy. but it is very comforting to have a vacuum cleaner like him at shortstop.
Yeah, and I mean, this past week has been obviously Alonso, Lindor tearing the cover off the ball. The offense has been looking better in general. I've liked the way that everyone's looked pretty much this week. There hasn't, other than, you know, obviously Eduardo Escobar has continued to struggle.
Sure.
But the pitching has looked well, has looked good too. I mean, they pitched Peterson, McGill, and they called up Jose Budo, who last time he came up, they got the win, but he didn't look particularly pretty out there.
Right.
They all looked fine.
Yeah. And I think that's the key word, because they all pitched well, but no one's ever going to trust them into the sixth inning. And I think that is the Achilles heel of the Mets starters right now. But for a while, it was difficult to get a good five innings out of any one of their starters, at least through the first couple of times through the starting rotation. I wouldn't have expected this out of Peterson, McGill, Buto. I think Peterson got the loss. I think he was the only loss of the week, but not on him. Like, I think he gave up two runs, and that's, you know, what you should expect out of someone who at best is your fifth starter. So I was pleasantly surprised by how well all three of those players pitched, and the other thing that it does is that it gives the Mets a little bit more time. If Max needs some more rest, if Verlander needs some more rest, they can take their time coming back, because they know that they'll could put Peterson, McGill, and Budo as starters and be in a decent enough position to win. Now, Budo is a little bit of a wild card because it was the A's after all, and not that the A's are a bad hitting team. They're certainly a better hitting team than they are a pitching team. But I want to see him against better competition before making a declaration of him being able to stay as a spot starter for this team. But yeah, I think they all pitched well enough, and that's all you can really ask for three guys who weren't on the starting rotation at the beginning of the year.
I also want to say that, and again, it's the A's, but Carrasco looked much better this time around.
He did. There were a couple of like mistakes early on, but seeing him settle down for like, you know, three straight innings is a start. Like, you want him to go five or six, obviously, because he's supposed to be one of your, you know, five best rotation pieces, but there is still no evidence of him being hurt, or at least no one has said anything to the contrary. But much like Peterson, McGill, and Budo, he pitched well enough. I don't know if there's anyone on the staff that like Mets fans would be excited to watch at this point, except for maybe Verlander, because everyone, including Kodai Senga, has shown their struggle so far. But for a team that's starting to ramp up the offense, whose relief pitching looks really good, and whose defense like looks pretty excellent, having a starting staff in this spot with three guys potentially on the injured list is a good position to be in for now.
Yeah, and I mean, Peterson and McGill looking better is definitely makes me a little more hopeful for the fact that now they're facing the Dodgers, but also they're facing the Dodgers next.
Yeah. And here's the rub. We're recording this on a Monday, and by the time this episode comes out, the Dodgers series will be over. So I don't know how prescient it would be to like preview a Dodgers series, but I'm nervous because I've watched the Dodgers this year and they're, as advertised, not as good as years past. But I don't really care about that because the Dodgers have the Mets number in the regular season for like the last few years that I've watched them. So I'm not looking forward to this swing of the West Coast trip. Hopefully they can take one or two in Los Angeles. I think that is a successful series from my perspective.
I mean, they're facing Syndergaard on Wednesday, and even if Scherzer doesn't look his best, Syndergaard's been looking mighty toasted.
Yeah, he's. I actually watched Noah in his first start against the Diamondbacks. I went to that game, and he looked really good, and I thought the Dodgers fixed him. I might have to change my mind because he's his fastball velocity is down and people are running all over him because that's just what they did before. And the problem's been exacerbated with these new rules. But yeah, I think I'm actually going to that Wednesday game. So I'll report back with my Syndergaard thoughts.
And then after Wednesday, they go to San Francisco. They do their up again portion of the West Coast trip, which is going to be, it's going to be a little weird seeing Michael Conforto in a different jersey because he spent all of last year out with an injury.
Mm-hmm.
So we've never seen him in a different jersey. I mean, I see pictures of him in the Giants jersey wearing the number 8. It just looks bizarre. And it's like there's a little piece of me that's like a little heartbroken over that.
Yeah, and not just Conforto. I don't know if you have the same sentimental feelings for JD Davis or Wilmer Flores. Certainly Flores, but we've had enough time to see Flores in different uniforms. We're like, yeah, that's, you know, that's normal. No big deal there. But the Giants have found magic in the Mets casted off right-handed hitters. And what makes that even more like heartbreaking is that the Mets don't really have a good right-handed designated hitter at this point. They have, in theory, a good left-handed designated hitter. And Vogelbach is certainly walking a lot, but he hasn't really hit very much. A Flores, a Conforto, a Davis, as they're performing right now for the Giants, would fit very well with this Mets team.
Yeah, I mean, the part of me thinks that with Davis after the end of 2021 and how 2022 started, that he just needed to go somewhere else. Like that, sure. It was just going to be too much of everything that was going on. It seemed like kind of a storm around him. I remember he was part of one of those interviews they did at the end of the 2021 season where he was basically like, yeah, I give it like a 40% chance I'm back. Like he seemed kind of like up, like sort of like already mentally moved on from the situation, assuming that they were just going to trade him that offseason. Conforto, that was just a bunch of weirdness all wrapped. They should have extended him, but then he got hurt and the mm-hmm. Boris stuff and Sandy Alderson all at the same time was too much. The Flores one will always sort of stick in my craw. I loved him. He was mm-hmm. he was my favorite player when I first got back into the Mets because there was a period of my teens where I stopped watching. When I came back, mm-hmm. it was I loved just everything about Wilmer Flores. He was just like the perfect player to root for. And I remember the day that this is getting a little emotional. This is the day that my grandfather died. I was obviously distraught. He got one of his many walk-off hits for the Mets that day. And it sort of like made me feel very, very emotionally happy because my grandfather, huge Mets fan. So for me, he'll always be such like a big part of my heart that I think until he retires, seeing him in any other uniform is just going to be emotional.
Right. And I think a lot of fans have that same sort of emotional connection to Flores. I don't think there's been a player for the Mets, maybe Brandon Nimmo, but even then, I don't think there's been a player that has expressed so much emotional sentimentality and connection to the team that brought them up as Flores has for the Mets. And I'm not saying, you know, retire his jersey or anything. And in retrospect, I can see why the Mets didn't commit to him. He's not a terribly good middle infielder, so you're expecting him to be a third baseman, really. And I can understand why they didn't expect him to hit as well as he has the past few seasons. And so I think ultimately I'm satisfied with the Wilmer Flores arc. I'm happy that he's succeeding somewhere else, especially outside of the NL East, so don't have to, you know, face him too often. I think the one that gets me is JD Davis, and not necessarily because JD Davis was like worth keeping around, but because the trade for JD Davis ended up with Darren Ruff, and Darren Ruff is like, you know, back at it again with the Giants after doing basically nothing for the Mets.
What a great trade for the Mets. The Giants ended up with every player they traded for Darren Ruff and Darren Ruff.
Yeah, I know. I don't know if the Giants are actually cheating, but I mean, that's some wizard magic that they pulled off right there.
Although, you know what? I gotta say, at this point, might not be a bad thing that they don't have a harder third base decision to make with Flores or Davis now that Brett Beatty has exceeded even my expectations for when he'd be called up and is coming up to the Mets, presumably, nothing's been fully announced by the team yet, today.
I have to wonder how that works. Like, who told Andy Martino this, and why has no roster announcement been made yet? Like, everyone is 100% convinced that, like, this is going to happen. I don't see a roster move. I don't see a lineup. I'm going to hold out my doubt until this actually happens. But yeah, all indications show that Brett Beatty is coming up.
Beatty just put up on his, I just called him Brady. Beatty just put up on his Instagram page a hype video with "on to the next #LGM" as his caption. So I've got to assume that someone in the organization knows that he's coming up and has told Brett Beatty. I just don't know what the move's going to be.
Yeah, I don't either. And it's not just and I don't know what the move's going to be because it hasn't been announced yet, but I don't know what the move's going to be in that I don't know what the Mets are going to do. What would you do? You play GM for a second. And here's the other rub with this, because the move is going to be announced later today. And by the time this airs on Wednesday, this is not going to be a mystery. So my incredulity is going to be fixed very, very soon. But again, Grace, what do you do in this situation? Who do you send down? Who do you trade? Like, what makes room for Brett Beatty?
In the immediate, and a lot of people don't want to do this, and even part of me is like, I don't know. In the moment, it would be cut Tim LeCastro, because really they're only using him as your Sunday starter, your defensive replacement, your pinch runner. That's where, you know, you add Brett Beatty to that situation, then you have a little bit more to move around. But I think, I don't know what they're going to do. If you had a little more time to do this, the real move would be, and I, again, don't like to say this, would be to find someone who might want to bite on Eduardo Escobar, eat some of those money, yeah, because you're essentially then just making a one-for-one swap in your roster construction. I genuinely don't know what they're going to do. I think that they could cut LeCastro. Weirdly, some people have been saying cut Vogelbach, which I don't think they do because he's one half of their constructed DH platoon. Mm-hmm. They could option Luis Guillorme, which would be absolutely bizarre at this part, but I could, yep, see them do it.
Yeah. The Guillorme one, unfortunately, is the one that I think some analytics heads could convince the GM that, like, this is what you need to do. Not because it's like what makes this the best team, but because he's got an option. And so you don't lose a player. You can send Guillorme down and bring him back up at any point. I think if you send LeCastro down, you're putting him on the waiver wire. I can't pronounce my W's and my R's very well. You're putting him on the waiver wire. Someone's going to pick him up. Because even though Tim LeCastro cannot hit at all, speed is valuable, and he's an automatic stolen base in the late innings as a pinch runner, and someone's going to want that. So trading Eduardo Escobar would be the best move. I don't know how easy it is to trade someone who's hitting. Is he hitting under 100 right now? I'm not entirely sure, like, where he is, but he's not exactly the most attractive trade option.
Eduardo Escobar is hitting a cool 125.
Oh, good for him. I'm glad he's above the 100 line on the interstate, which we recently learned is just a Keith Hernandez phrase.
It's just, it sucks because I like all these guys, but at the same time, like, I like Brett Beatty too. Like, part of me, again,
yeah,
I'm a very like emotional. I'll cry if the wind changes directions. But part of me is like, he's like the young guy. I remember when he got drafted, you know, it was, again, right after, mm-hmm, I started really paying attention to baseball. I remember when he got drafted, seeing him come through things, and then also the memories of, like, the last time the Mets had, like, a really stationary third baseman who just stayed with, who was the Mets' guy from the get-go, was David Wright. And so it's, you know, mm-hmm, and you don't want to put those expectations on him, but also mentally, somewhere in my subconscious, I'm putting those expectations on him.
The entire fan base is, and they want stability at third base because they have found stability at shortstop. They found stability at first base. McNeil theoretically presents you stability at second base if he weren't such a useful outfielder as well. And Brett Beatty for a lot of people feels like the final piece, that everything is going to be set the minute that Brett Beatty gets in there. And I think that's putting a little too much pressure on the guy. He might need to, like, you know, come up and hit before we can make any grand proclamations about his long-term viability on this team. But I think the other thing is that Brett Beatty is going to come up, and there's a possibility that he turns into Austin Riley, but then there's a possibility that he looks like Alec Bohm. And we don't exactly know like what this is going to turn out to be, but I would hope that people temper their expectations, don't get too emotionally attached to rookies, because there's a very good chance that they're going to come up and look like rookies, and that's okay. That's fine. That's a natural part of player development. I'm just asking fans to, like, you know, if he goes 1-for-12 to start off his major league career, don't, like, you know, throw pitchforks at him. I don't think people throw pitchforks, but you know what I mean.
Well, the fan base is, I've seen some people online already metaphorically throwing pitchforks at Francisco Alvarez. So I think if Beatty comes up and doesn't immediately hit 340, then he's going to be, there's some people who are going to be very, very mad and are going to call for him to be cut.
Yeah. And that's too bad. And I understand the frustration with Alvarez, because the issues are obvious. Like, it's very clear what pitches Alvarez is struggling to lay off of. It's very clear, like, when his defensive lapses happen, that those are the lapses that a rookie would make. And I think these things can be improved with over time. But I can imagine the patience boiling over if Beatty comes and, you know, does or has a similar efficiency as Alvarez does. But I'm still hopeful for Alvarez, still optimistic that, you know, getting him in for, you know, another month will help turn the ship around. I don't know if Buck Showalter is going to give him that run, but we'll see.
I mean, he's been, the last couple of days, I thought he was getting good bat to the ball. Like, there was that a couple of times yesterday where I was like, oh, wow, that's a pretty hard struck ball that just happened to go right at someone. So I think it's just a matter of time, hopefully. But again, like you said, if Buck doesn't want to play him, you know, then Buck's not going to play him. And then he's just stuck sitting on the bench waiting for his once or twice a week where he gets to, you know, hopefully try to prove himself. And I think that that's just, you know, not going to help this whole situation if he's sitting there going, oh, I got one day a week to show that I'm really made, you know, I'm really worth something. And then he swings at every high fastball he sees, which is not a uncommon problem for rookies to have. Remember when Pete came up for like the first year, 2 years, even sometimes now he swings at a pitch and I'm like, what are you doing?
Yeah, this is rookie stuff. And I'm not saying that derogatorily. I'm saying he's a rookie and he's going to do some rookie things. I think what really exacerbates Alvarez's pitch selection is that the Mets are a very patient lineup. Like, these veterans don't swing very much at all, but especially at bad pitches, the Mets take a lot of walks. And so when you put a free swinging rookie in the lineup, it only magnifies that issue. It would be one thing if, you know, Pete and Lindor were on a 200 strikeout pace, because you could compare that to what Alvarez is doing and still think, oh, he's on the right path still. Like, it's okay that he's striking out this much, because that's just what big league hitters do. But the Mets aren't striking out a lot. They're walking a lot. And if he's not doing the same thing, it feels like a really, really bad fit in the lineup, as it appears. But again, he's played like 5 games. Like, let's chill for a sec.
Yeah, I totally agree with everything you just said. I'm looking at the time, and we have so blown past the arbitrary limits that we put upon these sections. So why don't we take a little bit of... Yeah, we're really far past it. That's fine. Why don't we take a quick break, and then we'll come back and we'll get into the next portion of the show.
And we're back. We'll keep this portion a little bit shorter to compensate. But one thing that I want to talk about, because I don't think it's been examined very much, is how poorly Brooks Raley is pitching. By any indication, Brooks Raley was supposed to be one of like the core bullpen arms for the Mets this season. He was certainly the go-to lefty and still is the go-to lefty in the bullpen. But let's take a look at how he's been pitching so far. So Brooks Raley has a 65 ERA plus by based off of the players left in the bullpen, minus, you know, Dennis Santana, who's been DFA'd, Tommy Hunter, Steven Nogosek on the IL. That's the worst mark in the bullpen this season so far. And again, small sample size because he's only made 8 appearances so far and he's only pitched 5 1/3 innings, but he's given up 7 hits, 4 earned runs, 4 strikeouts. He has an 8.39 fielding independent pitching, which I understand is a mark that is not very descriptive of relief pitchers. But by any indication, Brooks Raley is not pitching very well. And in a small sample size, you know, no big deal, because a player of his talents can, you know, easily bring it back up. The reason why I want to bring this up is I want to ask you, Grace, how you feel about Brooks Raley not pitching well, because we've talked about this, you know, preseason. If you're unaware, Brooks Raley is a bit of a touchy subject with myself, especially. He was one of the 5 Tampa Bay Rays who, during a Pride event at Tropicana Field last year, refused to wear a patch on his hat that signified the Pride flag. And he's gone on the record saying that he doesn't want to stand up for that because of his Christian values. And him signing for the Mets this season was a bit of a disappointment on my end. And I went into the season disappointed that this signing happened, but also committing to not rooting against him, hoping that the Mets would do well despite Brooks Raley. But I think I'm feeling a little differently about that. So I want to ask you, like, what's your reaction when you see Brooks Raley struggle?
It sucks because I'm, you know, a Mets fan. I want to see the Mets succeed, but it sucks less than other pitchers, I guess would be the way I'd put it. Like, other pitchers, I'm like, oh man, that sucked. If he does really well, I'm like, let's go Mets. If he does really poorly, I'm like, well, that happened. And then I'm right back at it again, you know. Maybe if it came in higher leverage moments than April games that might not mean much at the end of the season, maybe then I'd feel differently. But right now I'm like, maybe pitching better should be part of your Christian values.
About that. I think your comment on leverage is like really key here, because so far, none of his appearances, I believe, have come at the expense of a Mets victory. I believe he's won in every single appearance the Mets have won in every single appearance that he's made. And he's not given up like a really big inning, but he hasn't looked good. And I didn't think at the beginning of the season that I would be rooting for Brooks Raley to do poorly. I'm doing that now. I'm going into every Brooks Raley appearance wondering, how can he mess this up in a way that does not hurt the Mets? And it's a very weird feeling to have. It's a very convoluted feeling to have. And I don't know if I'm proud of that feeling. This is just simply an emotion that comes up when I watch him pitch. I don't want him to succeed. I don't want him to fail so much that it comes at the expense of a Mets loss. But I want Brooks Raley to pitch poorly enough to take his $10 million contract elsewhere. I think that's where I'm landing on this.
My thing was, even when they traded for him before the season, my thought was always, it's never a great sign when the Rays are willing to move on from someone. You know, because they traded him. They actively said, we do not want you here anymore. We don't. Whatever the reasoning was, and the Rays aren't ones to just, you know, because I'm pretty sure all those other pitchers who were part of that protest are still there. Don't think it was because of that. So my thought was then was, how's this going to go? I just looked at his game logs. Really, the only big blow up was the one game where he gave up the four runs. Not like he's looked particularly great since then, but he's only been in two losses. One of them, he gave up four runs in the Milwaukee game that the Mets lost 9-0, which was already a lost cause by the time he got in that game. But sure. I agree with you. I'm part of me hopes that he can, that this keeps moving in this direction. And then, for however they do it, whether they cut bait, they trade him, whatever, that this works well enough that he leaves, because it's not like they have no one else who can do that. I mean, every single time David Robertson comes into pitch, they talk about his reverse splits. So it's not like they don't have anyone who can't get lefties out, and they have, you know, they have several good relievers. By the time the trade deadline comes, they can find a whole basket of them. There will be so many relievers available on the market. I don't want this specific reliever because I don't like him.
Nope. And I also want to examine like this specific feeling as well, because this is the first time I felt this way about a Mets player. And this isn't the first Mets player that I have found odious. This isn't the first Mets player that I've had negative feelings about, but this is the first Mets player whose success I'm actively rooting against. And this could be a result of me getting older. This could be a result of me having stronger feelings in one direction, but it feels as if like there is this weight on me where I need to better represent like my own personal interests through my fandom. And the best way to do that right now is to advocate in any way possible for Brooks Raley to get off this team. I think there's a possibility that I might regret that, especially fandom-wise, because like the Mets have a good bullpen right now, but it's relying really heavily on three arms in the back end, and that's not a sustainable practice for the Mets to have. Having an effective Brooks Raley goes a long way for a bullpen that's missing their best arm. So I do think there might be some regret in me if like he ends up pitching well and I end up, you know, feeling good about that for whatever reason. I reserve the right to have those feelings change. But yeah, I find it very odd that like after years of watching Daniel Murphy and Jose Reyes, whose success I never rooted against despite having, you know, negative feelings about them as people, that it's starting up for the first time in my life with this particular pitcher.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, there was a period in my teens when I stopped really paying that much attention to baseball. So when Daniel Murphy made those comments, I wasn't really that into baseball at the time. The same thing when all the Jose Reyes stuff really happened, I wasn't really into it. I mean, I started getting back into it in like 2018, the last season Jose Reyes was here. But, you know, there's other players on the team right now that we know that's what they believe also, that the stuff that Brooks Raley believes is very probably what they believe too. I'm Brandon Nimmo, but I love Brandon Nimmo because A, he doesn't broadcast that. Like, it's not like he's out there being like, I fucking hate this. When the Mets took the field in the rainbow shirts, he just wasn't there. And you know, that could be that he just wasn't out there, or it could be that he didn't agree with it, but there's enough plausible deniability that I don't have to look at him and see that in my mind every single time. When I look at Brooks Raley, I remember the statement that was put out by that group of players, and I remember the jersey that you could see the patch ripped off of, and the five of them with their different hats. Like, I can picture that all in my head, and I just see it when I look at his stupid little face.
Yeah, you don't even have to quibble about this. Like, it's I think it's objectively true that people who express their bigotry do more harm than people who keep it hidden. And I don't want to have players who have hidden bigotry, because bigotry is bigotry. But they affect less negative than they affect less negatively than those that broadcast it, i.e. a Brooks Raley type. So I don't want to harp on it too much. I don't want to feel like too negatively about this team. And I think I might feel bad about this the minute that like He comes in a high leverage spot against the Braves, and the Braves, like, you know, steal a game from the Mets if he doesn't pitch well. But like, yeah, it's a weird feeling that I'm having. I'm finding myself actively rooting against a Mets player, and not entirely sure how to feel about that.
It's just that, you know, if he stays the entire time, it's a year. So hopefully next year we never have to see his face again. And I'd love to see it happen sooner. In my mind, I'm already imagining the different relievers that the Mets could trade for and shoot Brooks Raley into the sun.
If I knew relievers better, I would have your imagination as well. But I'm not that versed with the rest of the MLB relief pitching landscape.
If Daniel Bard is back and doing well, I'd love to see him on the Mets. He seems like a cool guy.
He's the Phillies guy, right?
No, Daniel Bard's the guy with the Rockies who was he was the one who had the yips and then disappeared for a while and came back and didn't have the yips anymore, and then maybe got the yips a little bit in the World Baseball Classic and is on the reserve list, I guess, or whatever it is. He's taking time away from the game with anxiety, so I hope he's doing well. I hope he gets back to the way he's been going. And this is the last year he signed a 2-year extension with the Rockies a couple years ago. I think this is the last year of that deal. I'd love to see him on the Mets. He seems like a great guy.
Shout out Daniel Bard. Apologies for my ignorance. This is going to show up pretty constantly with relief pitchers.
All right, and now that I've said he's a great guy, he's going to milkshake duck. Sorry, I keep cutting you off while you're trying to cut us off.
Oh, it's okay. It's okay. It's okay. We're going to take a break now. Shout out Daniel Bard. We're going to come back with a little more banter. But until then.
All right. And we're back once again. What we didn't talk about in the second part, which I'd like to just do a little bit of coverage on since we are a queer podcast, is that Bud Light just sucks ass now, apparently, according to the makers of ultra right beer.
Nice. did it not suck ass before? Was I missing something?
I don't drink beer, so I have no idea how any of these things taste. So I just go by the cultural views. I know people who drink Bud Light and they seem to enjoy it. I don't know what that says about them, but I don't know what any of this means.
I need to ask because I only discovered who Dylan Mulvaney was thanks to a cursory Wikipedia search this morning. Did you know who Dylan Mulvaney was before this news broke? 16 days ago, by the way. That's how long the story's been in the cycle.
Yeah, I was aware of her. I've become aware of her maybe last year when she started the transition. I became sort of like a cultural touchstone in certain areas that I did sort of. So I'm terminally online. So I did I did see her, and from what I understand, this was literally just an ad that was on her TikTok page, and that was it. And now this is the biggest controversy since name a controversy. It was probably 2 weeks ago that they also got mad about some rainbow on something.
I only ask because I also watched the clip, and the clip is surprise innocuous. Nothing happens in it. She makes a few jokes about how she doesn't know what March Madness is. It leans a little bit close to sports ball, but it's just a 45-second nothing clip advertising Bud Light. And I'm asking you if you knew who Dylan Mulvaney was before this clip was released, because from what I've seen of her, she doesn't seem that controversial. Does she say outlandish things? Does she dress and dressing provocatively, like, does not, you know, merit any sort of harassment, but does she do anything besides be trans that people are upset about?
Yeah, no, I mean, the biggest thing that she had done before this, that again, every once in a while, a clip of her would go viral, because some conservative would get really mad about it, because she did like a series of videos that she might still be doing. I don't follow her that closely, but I do see her pop up on my feed every once in a while. Whatever day it was since her transition, you know, on the 27th day of being a woman, on the 151st day of being a woman. It's just little things where, you know, she's talking about her transition and everything like that. And it's generally pretty innocuous stuff that people get really mad about. Maybe she'll make like a little joke or do a little satire, and then they take it very seriously and very, very literally. I know she had one that went viral that was like, Her being like, oh man, I'm out of tampons again. And if you watch it, you can see that she's being so like sarcastic and like, this is, yeah. Oh, haha, we're having a joke. And then every right. single, because everyone got pissed off about it.
Yeah, I hope she has a very thick skin. I hope she has people protecting her because she seems delightful. She seems funny. She seems perfectly okay with who she is. And I love that about her. And this is just me based off that single 45-second ad that I saw. I'm glad that the news cycle has brought out a lot of the conservative hypocrisy that we've been seeing for the last few years being boiled down into this hatred for light beer. But it's such a weird and disheartening, but also kind of funny story because like, am I supposed to defend Bud Light now? Like, I don't have any connection to Bud Light. I don't want to drink it. I'm sure it's okay. But like, is that my place in the culture war right now? Do I just ignore this? What tell me what to do. I don't know what to do with this.
What's so funny is that every single way that the people who are angry at her are reacting is actively like so ridiculous when you give it 0.3 seconds of thought. So it's the people who are buying tons of Bud Light just to destroy it, which is always a favorite of mine in the boycott cycle, mm-hmm. where we buy a million things to destroy it. But Anheuser-Busch does not care what you do with their product once you buy it. They just care that you buy it. You are actively helping them here. The people who are going, well, I'm not drinking it. I'm going to drink this other beer. And it's either something that's owned by Anheuser-Busch that you don't realize is owned by Anheuser-Busch, so because they own like half the beer in America, or yeah. it's another brand that has also actively done like queer advertising. So mm-hmm. you, the thing that you're mad about with this one company, another company is doing that you're allowing them to buy, or personal favorite, we're going to create our own version of this that people mm-hmm. have now realized through a tiny bit of research that where ultra-right conservative beer is brewed is Northern Illinois, which presumably people have figured out is Chicago, because if it wasn't Chicago, they'd just name the town in Illinois, but if they say Chicago, then they'll get pissed off that they're doing stuff in Chicago. Mm-hmm. And of the two major breweries in Chicago that would be able to do this, the one of them is Anheuser-Busch. So they're just making Bud Light and that's, giving more money
awesome.
To them.
That's so awesome.
It's so funny. Every single bit about this is so funny. And what's the funniest part is that we're, what, a week into this controversy? We got, like, another week, and then it's over.
Yeah. I'm tickled by it. I'm saddened by it. It's awful. Everything about it is awful. But there's a little bit of funny in it too. And I'm so glad that you see it a lot funnier than I see it. I see it as a very violent and unnecessary harassment of an innocuous TikTok star. But I guess if I had any beer opinions, then I'd feel a little bit differently about this.
Yeah, my other thing is I know about her, I've seen her reactions to the ways that other people have sort of picked on her and tried to tear her down or whatever. And she does seem to have like a very thick skin and good sense of humor about it all, where she sees sort of the ridiculous nature of it. And she's fine. She's got like 1.5 million followers on TikTok. She'll be fine.
Oh, awesome.
Like
awesome.
She's perfectly good. That's the reason why they got her to do the ad, because she's got 1 million followers on TikTok. She's yeah. fine.
Awesome. Well, shouts out Dylan Mulvaney. Thanks for making everyone mad. Thanks for bringing some humor into the culture war.
We'll Grace, see you in the culture war again in about 2.5 months.
Love it. Grace, do you have a movie for us this week?
Yes, I do. I feel kind of bad because I meant to rewatch this movie this week. I haven't watched it in a little while, but I am still going to recommend it because it's culturally somewhat relevant. I had read the book Daisy Jones and the Six, and I just recently watched the series that they made based on it on Amazon Prime. Series is very good. The book's very good. Interesting story. The show's like, I've got some problems with the show, but generally I had a great time with it. Riley Keough is a star. What I want to recommend is the 2000 film. Let me just make sure I get this year right. It doesn't matter. Everyone knows this movie anyway. Yeah, the 2000 film by Cameron Crowe, Almost Famous, which has very similar vibes to Daisy Jones and the Six, while also being like a complete masterpiece and such a fantastic film. Fantastic, great soundtrack. The performances are amazing. You've got like a little teeny tiny small role from Philip Seymour Hoffman, just again, giving it his all. Kate Hudson's fantastic in it. I think she got nominated for the Oscar for it. She's great in that movie. But it's, if you like Daisy Jones and the Six, and, or even if you just like 70s music and good movies, this movie is fantastic. The screenplay, just like most Cameron Crowe movies made before he got bad, the screenplay is amazing because he's very inspired by Billy Wilder. And I always love that sort of like kind of snappy, but also insightful screenplay. So Almost Famous. If you haven't seen it, watch it. If you've seen it, watch it again.
You throwing Cameron Crowe under the bus at the end there. I'm not going to let that slip. This is the man who directed We Bought a Zoo.
They sure did buy that zoo.
I'm so glad they did, too.
He also directed Aloha, where we got the absolutely amazing casting of a part Chinese woman, Emma Stone, there with Scarlett Johansson playing an Asian character in Ghost in the Shell. Those two came out very close to each other. It was a very weird time in like the film landscape to have to look at those two things and just go, oh god.
I'm looking at a Wikipedia page right now. The only Cameron Crowe movies I've seen are Say Anything and Jerry Maguire, and I happen to love both of those movies, and so I'm willing to give him some benefit of the doubt. And how does Almost Famous compare with those two?
Okay, so I adore early Cameron Crowe. Like, you go back before Elizabethtown is probably the cutoff. Vanilla Sky, I think, is fantastic. In my mind, Say Anything, Jerry Maguire, Almost Famous are like a trilogy where this man made three of the greatest movies ever made. Like, in my opinion, they're all three are in my top 50. I think they're all fantastic films. If I were to rank them, Almost Famous would be number three, but that's only because I love Jerry Maguire and Say Anything so much, and they're both in my top 15. Like, that is, I'm so serious about those two movies that Almost Famous being like number 45 or whatever on my list, it's still so fantastic.
I also have to point out, Cameron Crowe went to Claremont High School in San Diego. That's where my mom went. I have no idea if they crossed paths. I'll have to ask her.
I mean, he wasn't in high school a lot as a kid because Almost Famous is based on his real life. He, at age 16, wrote for Rolling Stone. So he followed around, what band was it? The Allman Brothers. He followed the Allman Brothers around on tour when he was 16. He was writing big articles for Rolling Stone at 16. And then at a certain point, at 22, I'm looking on his Wikipedia page as well. At 22, he went undercover in a high school to write Fast Times at Ridgemont High. This man has the craziest life ever. He married Nancy Wilson from Heart. It's just amazing.
Oh, this is making a lot more sense now. Cameron Crowe did not go to Claremont High School. He went undercover at Claremont.
Yep.
I'm seeing this a lot more clearly now.
So Fast Times at Ridgemont High is based on late 70s Claremont High School.
My mom was in high school in the late 70s. I wonder if there's a character like based off of her. She was a valedictorian too. I need to ask her these questions. This is very important.
Yeah, so you know what? Now my recommendation is every film Cameron Crowe made up until Vanilla Sky. If you want to watch any one of those, go for it.
Yeah, I'm already halfway there. So I think I'll give Almost Famous a shot. Do you know where I can find Almost Famous?
I will look that up right now.
Obviously, yeah, any, you know, Amazon, YouTube, they probably have, you know, those for rent, I'm sure. I'm just trying to find a way not to pay $3.99 for a movie.
Yeah, so it looks like it's on Paramount Plus. It's also on the Roku channel for free.
Oh, hey.
Yeah. So that probably has commercials in it, but still, that's totally free. You don't need a subscription for that one.
Nice. I don't care about commercials so much. I'm cool with those.
As long as they put them in the right spots.
Yeah. Speaking of commercials in the right spots, I think we should probably end our second episode. Any last words before we take off?
Hoping that the rumors are true and Brett Beatty's in the lineup tonight. And if they aren't, I'm going to be very sad.
Well, you're going to have to wait until 10 o'clock your time to find out, because the Mets are on the West Coast.
Yeah, so I'm going to be up until 2 a.m.
Love it. Love it. All right. Well, thanks, everyone, for listening. We truly appreciate your patronage. We do not have any way to talk to us right now. We'll definitely look into an email or a Twitter account very, very soon. But until then, let's go Mets.
Let's go Mets.